My wife has only seen a Pink Day once. We've been together 15 years. She's got a new boyfriend. That's what she did. Alright. Hey. Thanks for coming out. Thanks to White Whale. Everybody here joining us in person. Everybody on the Zoom. Thanks for Ab. Big night, Mr. Ab. And thanks again for Ab for caving to our demands to put in a beer tax. They so desperately wanted the anyway's readings here that they agreed to that. So, thank you. I spent a good portion of my day in the dentist chair. And all I can say about that is that drugs are really great. Thank God for that. This is a poem by James. It's called Northern Pike. All right. Try this. Everybody I know and care for, and everybody else, is going to die in a loneliness I can't imagine, and a pain I don't know. We had to go on living. We untangled the net. We slid the body of this fish open from the hinge of the tail to a place beneath the chin I wish I could see. I would just assume we let living go on. An old poet whom we believe in said the same thing. And so we paused among the dark cat hens and prayed for the muskrats, for the ripples below their tails, for the little movements that we knew the crawdads were making on the pond, for the right-hand wrist of my cousin, who is a policeman. We prayed for the game warden's blindness. We prayed for the road home. We ate the fish. There must be something very beautiful in the pond. Recently, a friend of mine read that poem at the James Ray Festival, which is starting up again recently. If you didn't get to check it out, I think it's going to happen again every year. So keep it on your calendars. And she's a huge Ray fan, as I understand. And I felt really nervous going into the day, sitting on a panel discussing my work. The immensity of it. She said she was really worried and she just felt out of place going in. And she read the poem as a part of a panel discussion with another poet with, I guess, a very nice CV and a right biographer, also sitting on the panel with her. And I think her nerves got her a little bit. If she read the poem or something, but she loved her and what Wright says to her. And she wanted to speak about that loneliness that Wright addresses in the poetry. That is a loneliness that has been identified recently as an epidemic in America. It was something that really was, she responded to, definitely. It meant that she had those problems. And so going into the day, I think she felt a little overwhelmed. But the people who sat on the panel with her didn't really help the issue. And she said coming out of it, she just felt lonely and out of place. Like maybe she just shouldn't have done that. She's a fan. What did she have to say? The last time we were here, 2 weeks ago, Joan was talking about Jimmy Savitt, who started the series back in 1974. So we're approaching 50 years of Hemingway next year. So the Lord knows him. You better put martinis on the bar to be on the seventh. Jimmy was asked to do the series, I think, by Bruce Bilger. And what Bruce was looking for was a summer series and somebody to run it who was not beholden to or gave preference to any of the writing programs in the city, of which you know, men, top quality. And I think that was a good choice in Bruce's part, to get Jimmy. Because Jimmy was a non-denominational. Jimmy loved God. He wasn't really concerned about the church. And that proceeded into his approach to poetry and the practitioners. And so Hemingway's was always designed out of the gate to be a space of welcome, not a space of judgment or gatekeeping or anything like that. And Jimmy, 1974 on, did that exceedingly well. And he took his poetry seriously, even though most of his poems contained a fart joke or two. They were serious poems, which he leavened with a lot of humor and a lot of humanity, because that's who he was. And that's what he believed poetry was about, people. And that everybody should be welcome at that table. And I hope what we get as we continue without Jimmy is that spirit. Nobody sitting in this room, nobody standing at this microphone, nobody at Zoom should ever feel small or left out or like they haven't been invited to be here. Like you don't belong. Of course you belong. Poetry. Everyone fucking belongs. That's the point. You should not feel lonely because of us. I hope you don't. I never do. And I thank you. And thanks to White Whale and everybody reading tonight, Jan, Michelle, Sean, Fred. Thanks for being a fun. Yeah, I'll turn it over to Jan.
You're going to go right.
Thank you, Chris. Exactly. We are thrilled to be here tonight and celebrating poetry and celebrating community. And as always, thanks to White Whale, you folks have given us the wonderful thing. And it's just such a blessing to be able to be here. Our poets this evening are Michelle Stoner, Fred Shaw, John Rep, and Jan Beatty. There it goes. And I'm going to start. I will introduce each of them individually. And then each will read, and then I have a closing poem and a couple of things I want to share with you. Here we go. Michelle Stoner is the author of the poetry collection Lats and Riots, and her work has appeared in numerous journals and anthologies, most recently in the Westmoreland Museum of American Art in Pittsburgh, on pieces that explore the intersection of poetry and visual art. Michelle holds an MFA in creative writing from Carleton University and is currently a poetry instructor in the Mad Women at the Attic Creative Writing Workshops. Please welcome Michelle Stoner.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Okay. Hi, everyone on Zoom. I'm delighted to be here. It's so nice to see you. I want to thank White Whale as well. I hope that you know what a wonderful community you create for all of us, and it's really important. We're grateful. I want to thank Chris and Joan for keeping this torch going and making things happen, and for this invitation. The invitation is wild because unbeknownst to them, John Rep was my very first poetry teacher ever. Yeah, cool, right? And I learned so much from him. And then I went on to graduate school to study with Jan Beatty. And he was a former, he was a college here, and learned a lot there. And one of the legends in my MFA program was Fred Shaw. So it's a very cool evening to be part of. Being able to read alongside of all of you is really meaningful. This is called Teens in the Strip Lines. Like quaaludes and poppies crushed in a rocks glass, sit. The strips had colors like an oil spill. In that hollowed out land of no vegetation, mud and clay, monoliths collapsing in on themselves, pliable. We'd sneak bottles of liquor and spend the night there. Jean, Emily, Don, and I, sometimes Lori, up through morning. We'd marvel at the cliffs with angles severe and bald, the scoured land, guess about the trees that used to be there, vast forests, the rest of the world we wanted to see, so lush. Mountains topped and mined, pitted from the inside out, land sliding, we always went there in the rain. We decided this was a softened chocolate egg of a mountain, that a dolly arch we'd climb at sunrise, purples and rust smeared in the bedrock as we passed whiskey between us. So lately, I've been very interested in the tension between things, particularly stuff that's presented as binaries, and how I'm most comfortable as a person and most interested as an artist in the third space that that tension creates. There are all kinds of ways that this shows up for us, push and pull, and it's different for everyone. For me, it has a lot to do with wounds and healing, or that I think that I'm a pretty tough person who is also often afraid. So I've chosen to take up this idea in the manuscript that I've been working on through the operating metaphor of predator and prey, and exploring the relationship of the two of those within myself. This poem is called Snakes to Remove Me, Make Me, and the title is the first line. Snakes to remove me, make me forget, to let them wail it out while I'm gone, mother and father, no brother with an ear kept low to the ground yet, just me with my keepers. And the ant in town knows it, and the snake show on tour, and what a distraction, arriving in pits, rusty coils, pale sky, dry summer above me, and tall men all over handling with their fingers spread, twisting animals in the air. This is called Like Liquid Under Warm Light. From the flattening in the hill that kept climbing beyond us, through the little window and then the back door, I learned the gold fill of watching a beloved, how stomach and legs go buoyant, how good it felt to climb over thorns, weaving through the growing brush in the evening up the hill, behind our little house, to gaze at my mom making dinner, moving stove to table, table to sink, for my brother and me, on her own, streaming like warm honey through the kitchen, still in her hand-me-down suit and heels. So if that's my mom, this one is my dad. This is called expired plus processed equals dead plus gutted. It's hunter speak. The hunters use euphemisms so they don't have to look at what they're doing. And if there are any hunters in the audience, I feel complicated about it. I don't just feel one way, I understand. But this is actually about my dad. Expired plus processed equals dead plus gutted. 80 yards of the arrow, 50 out from the tree stand, is where he stumbled then, expired. Dusk of killing plus heat moves in where the cold should be equals steam off your body, steam of the gut pile. Chill gone these past years, everything changing but this ritual of your heart tearing through another's. And this one is called Kavanaugh and the Rut. It has two epigraphs. The first one is, the rut is characterized in male animals by an increase in testosterone, exaggerated sexual dimorphisms, and increased aggression and interest in females. The second is a headline, Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court, October 6, 2018. Ooh. She grazes on her own. Grasses bend and return with her slow glide. Flick of the ears, whiff of the air. She walks evenly into the dark of the woods. Each day sensing, eventually, one will come up from behind when the muscle and wet froth, white haunches will push to summit her insurmountable spring because it is fall. So predator prey thing, when you are in danger, oftentimes creatures will run. I did a word search of my manuscript at one point, and the number one word that came up was the word run. I think now it's probably deer. I've been writing a lot about deer. This poem is called To the Fleeing, and it also has an epigraph from Frank O'Hara. What is the poet for, if not to scream himself into a hernia of admiration for all paradoxical entanglements? Great, it's like a great aside. I was a salvo there, how, in the dusk where I lost myself on a mountain, circled past the same caving shed three times, and the second self came out, the rough one, who makes me find trails in places I've never been to, walks straight towards the height, starts climbing, tears through the street, and swigs lightning once she's down. And this one is called Baking Bread in Patagonia. Silent morning walked me through field and fog to the warm oven hut, stucco, square, farmhand built for baking bread only, and filled with the smell of yeast and cherry wood. In still air, I stood with Lorenzo, sculpting loaves, his chapped hands smoothing out the lumps. We watched pink fruit trees beneath the mountain in silence, raising and firing. I coated loaf pans. He punched wet pods of dough in up to his elbows, the muscles of turning something over. Pinholes of white the night before burned through the quilt of darkest bottom of the world's sky, and I slept a cloud under it. And then interestingly for me, when things got really dangerous, I came home. I washed my hands bloody because you were dying. My blood was sick with ritual, with ritual, with repeat, because control is a sieve and days can be tapped to the wall. Walls of my house becoming my mind, becoming tamed, their wood, I knock four times, bow in the hallway, pick skin, look directly at the corner where the light hits the corner, stare until the corner is right. Where the music is high and my feet are apart, spin each side the same way twice so I can keep you from hemorrhaging yourselves from breaking apart. This poem is, the title is actually the Irish word for ghost, which I am not going to try to pronounce. It's spelled T-A-S-H. I think it's like times or something, but anyway, that's the title. I call the doe to eat the berries I toss, conjure whiskey into a glass for the fast food, for the fear settled right in my blood. I water herbs, cook, bring my mother forth. Sitting in my nose is her mother, the rye, ancient, kitchen steaming, and the sun in the fruit. I ask what happens to my mania, energy, spin little circles inside, outside. I wonder what comes of inheritance, goes when it ends. I can't sleep. A dream of women, the long mix in me, honey and bite, elated, afraid, swell, and fall, rouse them in a space not entirely awake, vital, just sick, not sickly. It stings, ecstatic. The tomatoes ripen each day. Next week, I will make her sauce. And as I was thinking about ending this reading, ending manuscript endings, I feel like people always have ideas about that, a good ending, bad ending. And so I'm just interested in being and all the things that means. This poem is called Stagambit. Whitetail on train tracks that cut deep into Maryland. Thick reeds and kudzu, your head surrounded by light. We keep singing all week, mouths full of beer, fists pounding. I try to sleep. I sleep. I dream about love across species, my capacity for love, all those I've abandoned. You read to me about two women sharing a life, and we have the fire in front of us. It's like the wall of snow and ice, 10,000 feet up Mount Humphreys, when I started in meadows. By the time I got there, foot over foot, breath after breath, scaling was the best possible thing. A climb on the cold slab, the sky an arch over my clear head, because the planet is a circle we walk on. The things we need spring from the center, no matter our certainty and doubt. Thank you so much.
Great, thank you, Michelle. Brad Shaw was named Emerging Poet Laureate finalist for Allegheny County in 2020. I'll go with you there. Okay. He is a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh and Carleton University, where he received his MFA, his first and quite wonderful collection. Scraping Away was published by Cavan Perry Press. Brett is a book reviewer and poetry editor for Pittsburgh Quarterly. And his poem, Argot, is featured in a 2018 full-length documentary, Eating and Working. The film focuses on the lives of local service industry workers. His poem, Scraping Away, was selected for the Pennsylvania Public Poetry Project in 2017, and Fred will be teaching full-time at Pitt in the fall, and I am really happy to hear that, and those are lucky kids to have him there. Hey, please welcome Fred Shaw.
All right, you want to hear me okay? Good. It's really awesome to be here. I second everything that Michelle had to say from White Whale, kind of taking over this to these esteemed folks that I'm getting to read with. And it's really great to just read in front of people. I've been doing some jazz poetry concerts in the month of April. And so it's kind of, it's a little bit interesting not having a band backing me. So it's kind of doing it on my own. It's also can be a little bit of a tightrope walk. So I'm glad to just be able to read and kind of do my thing. So the book is Scraping Away, which I have some copies for sale that I suspect some of you are familiar with, but I've been working on a second manuscript. So I'm going to be mostly reading, hopefully, poems that are, you know, newer to you folks that aren't included in the book. Not sure when the manuscript is going to actually happen. It's, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of the way there, but we'll see how that plays out. So some restaurants, some music play poems, and we'll see what you think of it. So this first poem is called Soup Bone Says. Soup Bone said, put a fan on it, because that's how we parch with stills here. Caged metal blades carving the air, blowing loose scraps into crumb-lined corners. A recipe for disaster is what we call this place, built on fried zucchini and foot-sized fish sandwiches. It's brown kitchen tiles, iced tea slick. Septuagenarian, Soup Bone moves bare-hunched and bow-legged, surveying his dining room with its walls decked in gimcrack, tables ringed with those teal leather chairs our aging regulars love. His red tie swinging from a starched shirt steeped in woodsy cologne. He greets everyone by name before chirping, kick it back now, good buddy. Sometimes glad-handing blue hairs with best wishes on their birthday dinner. Sometimes offering a scoop of rainbow sherbet when hot food gets served cold. Other days, he'll dub us shammers, the word hissing from his nose after finding half trays full of butts and a soaked rocks flask swimming with water. Yet for the rest of our restaurant lives, he'll remain that minor chord, reminding us to stay busy before the sugar high of another lunch rush fades, summoning us to run warm plates topped with strip steaks and steamed veggies. The grouch in his voice at odds with a string version of Blackbird leaking from the ceiling speakers, leaving us to feel like we're someplace close to home when he barks, "Let's hustle," the only answer to all it is we ever need to do. I think something that Chris said in his opening statement was pretty right on. Was the idea that poetry, you know, is about the human condition and about like making these kind of human connections. And something about the world of restaurants has kind of allowed me to explore that. It's allowed me to kind of think about how important it is to have people in poems. And so those are certainly some of the things I've been exploring. This poem's from my father at a camp in Forest County. I'll first catch song from my father as Steely Dan churning in the tape deck between the thin walls of this two-room cabin, biting what I'll later come to dig, Horace Silver's opening bass notes, the piano vamp and a Joe Henderson solo, phrasing that sounds more like a blossom end. What began here, I'll come to know as Dad's midlife fade, wrapping itself in the echoing call of a hermit thrush, an acorn dropping a rim shot on the steel roof, his empty beers clinking on the glue stain for mica, where I'll build plastic models of hot rods. Now, at 50, I'm starting to hear the tracks played rhythm and staccato fiddles as the clipped replies of a man who made promises by night he'd never keep. Yet it nudged his son awake each school morning, smelling of speed stick in his first cigarette of the day, guzzling instant coffee before pulling the front door closed behind him. Back then, I couldn't know that I'll someday be fatherless and without child, or that the Botman's biggest hit will come to fill my ears with what sounds like equal parts anthem and lament. This next poem is called Shivery, and I came across it in a lit mag, the word. It means a mocking song for like a mocking wedding song, like people beating on pans, that sort of thing. I just thought it was a cool word, and it was ended up finding its way into this. So, chivalry. The busboy's belly growls before every dinner shift. His salted horizon stacked with slippery plates, toted two-handed, belt high. The load-worn grips on those gray plastic tubs slip and ready to snap. When the busser thinks of tomorrow, a stain worries his only tuck shirt, a splash of red sauce lurking about the forks, pulling a puddle of watery Merlot. At the dish pit, he pauses to shred what's edible, resting atop another load, vanishing to the back hall with a veal shank, glistening marrow. Crowd of found calories, the umami worth tucking into. He leaves the slop and scraping for the scullion, a tweaker picking a hockey puck steak, some cold lasagna, a dead piece of sole. Nightly Burtons return from the dining room, swimming with booze on the arm, kept women and Nat King Cole stuck and repeat. In time, a few bucks get pressed into his bleach-soaked palm, letting the buster forget about pans clanking in a pot sink like a shivery, mocking what grows quiet in his back pocket, folded and not yet wed with ache. This next one is kind of my Point Park poem, kind of a true story. It's punk rock as it gets to me, I guess. So the title is To the Fuckhead Who Stole My Bike. Thursday, after another day's last class ends, I step into the dry heat of a yellowing Indian summer, only to find an empty space where I left my bike. Letting the sin of theft turn disbelief into blame, my eyes, a pointer wagging all over the ripped and torn of Wood Street, the chopper's cheap weed making the block reek, while the slap boxers connect with their combos, and that stringy dude in a Pornhub hoodie runs game on another pinch-faced bus stop girl. Later, the cops show you to me, bulky and bucko capped, your slick black tracksuit making you both shadow and blind spot on the secure feet of your work, where all that's needed is 7 seconds to spring those spare notes from another clip lock. And what comes after is you atop my pedals, palming sweat around the grips, dry mouth and gunning with the bebop of another poster at its last dip. The valves of your heart opening and closing without fail until you could be. The desperation, which began with a Diamondback snatched from an open garage that summer at turn 12, granting me a season of scuttling along behind a flock of rolling friends, jealous of the smell of rubber folded into the insistence of all those freewheels clicking. It's another restaurant poem, I'll wrap some things up with restaurant poems. The past, for those of you that haven't worked in a restaurant, is kind of where the chefs will, the cooks will put up the food. Usually there's like a heat lamp in there. And usually it's also a place kind of bannering back and forth. Lots of fun stuff happens in the past. In the past, a regatta of hands spawned the hum of this stretch, voicing a kitchen stainless with the singed and scarred lyrics. The singed and scarred carry lyrics of sweat and onions beneath their stained white aprons. This last refuge for tatted men to preach into boiling grease, while the cross-eyed dishwasher lets his radio croon with the Commodore's tall tales about easy Sunday mornings. In the past, someone's working off last night by chugging Kool-Aid, the color of blood running rare on a platter of prime rib resting beneath the heat lamp's searing orange coil. In the past, a testy chef chews his lip while zesting an orchard of green apple over a peppery dish of risotto, squinting his way to soignée by slicing a plump of roast duck into a shingle, letting it rest atop a blueberry demi brushed into a comet's tail, finished with a nasturtium tweezer until it floats, a lily pad on a pond of China. In the past, impatience sounds like a dusty Epson printer clicking out chips until they reach the cracked tiled floor, fixing tempo to the clatter and bang of countertops, and a cook who butters his bread by making a mark with the new server until she can't forget how to cradle atop her palm and wrist another scorching plate, baited to singe a yielding skin until it blisters. I've been, I don't want to say accused, but a remark that I like to write elegies. I sometimes don't realize that I'm doing that, but one of the things of working in restaurants, just working with people in general, is that unfortunately some of them will not always be there. And so a few years ago, I got a call. I actually got an email from a former student while I was in class, and students were doing something else to look into, like that something had happened to this young man, and sure enough, something had. It was really, really pretty sad to have seen somebody so full of promise to just kind of pass away very, very unexpectedly. So this is for Nigel Pega. And the poem is called Comfort. Without warning, the busboy died in his bed after school. The genes of his heart finished ticking toward failure. And for guiding him through the world of service, his stepfather will bless me in Devlin's plush parlor, among the sweet-smelling sprays of lilies and mums, as I wait for my turn to kneel before the open casket, framing its body in repose, listening to the murmurs of others searching for answers after finding none in the prayer cards or small talk which follows. It'll take months and a slow dinner shift to get me thinking again of that awkward, shaggy boy, mocked for his smell and the way he puppy dogged one patient waitress. His name, still listed on the wall-bound schedule, greets me as weekly comfort, reminding me of those down times when we talk film, Scorsese, his favorite. Looking to widen the lens, I burned him copies of Pickpocket and Yojimbo. Adding a few sets of techno, I hoped he'd hear like a soundtrack. But tonight, finding a stack of discs marked in my scrawl, after reading the server's side stand, I'm left unsure of what to do with worthless things gathering in corners, like the memory of finding that young man having his first smoke with the dishwashers, telling lies and wearing greasy shoes, their laughter sprinkling the ground after every lick of ash. And I'll wrap things up with something that hopefully some folks get a couple of chuckles out of. All of these are true stories that have either happened to myself or people that I've worked with that I decided to borrow those experiences. Worst shift ever. The worst shift ever begins before the sun goes down, when with a bead of sweat at the temple, you read the chef's specials to a floor top, already moist, the air conditioner wheezing along in a heat wave. They blame you in silence for its lack of function. On the worst shift ever, you will serve brown water, poured because somewhere a main has snapped and it's a full house. On the worst shift ever, you will get cut, then get asked to cut lemons a sting that makes you forget the chafe burning in the crotch of your dickies. On the worst shift ever, your guests will find a used Band-Aid in their onion soup and a dead cricket in their field greens. The idiot manager will tell them it's good luck. On the worst shift ever, you will congratulate a rotund woman on her pregnancy, only to be told she's not expecting. On the worst shift ever, you will get to explain to one of your former students seated in your section, the one who loved reading Murakami, what it is you're doing here. You will buy him dessert. The worst shift ever begins with you missing the alarm, then arguing with your girl before finding that the only clean pair of boxers are stretched and sagging at your hips. The worst shift ever is a summer Sunday afternoon, manning a slow double while the rest of the world enjoys the sun. You will get busy and want to stab. On the worst shift ever, you will find out your father is in the hospital, or you've been diagnosed with lupus, or that your dog's been found paralyzed. You will be asked to finish waiting on your tables before clocking out. The worst shift ever happens when your worst hangover gets multiplied by a busser who is called off, and the other servers are no call, no show. The worst shift ever is a dishwasher without any crack to smoke, or when you get torn cartilage in your ribs, or find a piece of glass digging into your toe. The ER visit will take hours. The worst shift ever isn't when the staff threatens to quit, or when the building gets zapped by lightning, leaving you in limbo, but might be finding on the one night you finish early that your car has been towed. And if it ends, it ends after midnight with you huddled at a table, working on some type of a second drink, counting the wrinkled bills, getting yourself sealed to do it again and again and again. Thank you, folks.
John Rapp is a poet and fiction writer living in Erie, Pennsylvania. His most recent collections of poems are The Soul of Rock and Roll Poems Acoustic, Electric, and Remixed 1980 to 2020, Broadstone Books. It's a lot of poems. And Cold Running Current from Alice Greer and Company. It is so much, so great to have John Rapp. Been here a couple earlier occasions, but this time it really worked out. Please welcome John Rapp.
I'd like to say much of anything. Is it possible to get a cup of water? Well, that's happening. It's wonderful to be here among all of you. And folks I haven't seen in flesh for a long time, and if you really have been listening to the new poems of Michelle Stoner, and for the first time, poems of Rich Hess, delightful. Raise up the mic. Speak into the mic, that would be. How's. You didn't hear half of that, right? Yeah, so it's delightful. It's delightful. And thank you to Joan. Thank you to Joan and Chris, the white whale, to everybody who I may have forgotten. So the bakery. One day,
We drove to my uncle's bakery for pound cake, bread, and the poppy seed buns. I nibbled clockwise from the rim to the white icing food in the center. He baked such terrible bread, we balled the loaves into the bluegill bowl. Seem pompous, those who eat them suspect. Uncle Phil had lost most of his tongue cancer by then, but he was easy to understand. Aunt Florence nodded the strength while the brothers looming over me talked. A newspaper appeared, the whole front page, a photograph my father snatched away. Somehow, I knew Marilyn Monroe had been here, but wasn't thought ready to. Trevellini's buns were so much better, it was ridiculous, but we went there in secret. The first line of this poem is also its title. When Mike Sparks held the 30-06 in his mouth and pushed his big toe down, pieces of skull spun to the floor. No blood flew out. Mike Sparks lay back loose and easy. That's how I imagined it anyway, as Bruce Malone told what he heard. Linda Falcone snoring delightfully. Felicia trying not to giggle. This was our first day of high school, and what loveliness we've come into that summer. How was it so suddenly possible for the blue glistening vein in Linda's temple to move like that when she drawled her Minnesota drawl? This was before the White Album and Earth Day and our own race war, before anyone we knew got high or drafted or actually got naked with anyone else. This was when the body counts still cheered me, when I still wanted to be like Custer, when remembering how Felicia's chest moved every time she breathed taught me gratitude. Yet Mike Sparks wasn't there anymore. I held my breath. Things got fuzzy. My heart slowed and drummed louder. Everything would disappear like magic. I kept holding it. Things changed. This is one of my several, it's not that matters, but one of my several grumpy old guy poems. I'm going to soon close a poem that ponders the mystery of how gift became a verb. This is called Some Random Issues. Things are so much more random now. What with all the issues everyone has, especially when going off on someone or having been gone off on, or going off of what someone says without first feeling them or her or him, so no words get put in mouths. I mean, what you put out comes back on you, but to stray from my lane a second, let me pull your coat about this random thing, because it looks this old head like memes are another thing, right? Sculpt the hat Pharrell Williams rocked when he first got big. Dude looked like a miniature Tom Mix, you feel me? Whitest dude in the movies till Gene Autry, but still. Dang, I came up when it was dope to wear a coonskin cap. So I know from stupid looks, but phew, Pharrell ain't the only one who needs a new haberdasher. Hate me for harshing so hard, but every TikTok makes my home in the land of Maypole more freaky. Country where one store one's milk in the frigid air and handkerchiefs had yet to become Kleenex. Neutrons never used to be random. Electrons once orbited. No way gamma could ever modify knife. Notice a proton or it isn't? Grot rat, dude. Binary to the max. I have a size 8 head, so I can flip anywhere, believe you me. And now we have an enraged old guard poem called Improvisation on a Journal Snippet. Do this air parentheses with magazine article or another psychotic ape poem. I am 44 years old, wrote I at 44. I feel portentous and belligerent, I continued. Has the mom father bearing his son piggyback through their village because the son cannot rely, nobody could, on ankles the circumference of my thumbs ever bemoaned or even wool gathered, the wispiest urge to contemplate his age or emotional temperature. No matter how incisive or despairing or lethally obtuse the question, the dioxin that so befouled several Laotian provinces, infants without eyes slide from their mothers 50 years after the last total war molecule settled somewhere on those hectares of ground. What? The dioxin, what? Ransacked the OED in vain for an adequate verb. I'm 70, and the taxes I first paid in 1969 bludgeoned me. How sort pennies for Social Security from pennies for Lockheed, Dow Chemical, the Atomic Energy Commission, strict enforcement of the fair housing? The budgetary fucking allocations, the fucking euphemisms, the silver-haired fucks bartering shitloads of powdered milk for freight cars sloshing with blood. I stacked 30 dozen cartons of eggs to pay for that. My father sold bottles and bait to pay for that. My drop from sight friend Don plopped his platoon in a Charlie 3 plot of jungle to smoke dope and empty clips at the sky till they trudged home to report a fantastical body count for that. My mother got bitten by kids labeled emotionally disturbed for that. A former in-law, a song made rich, tortured himself into a mustachioed pretzel every year to avoid paying a penny more than his genius accountant made possible for that. His that totted up the rickets and goyisha beatings his body could never forget, despite the East Asian Buddhas and Mughal tapestries cramming the floor through apartment a block west of Zaytoven. The humpback 13-year-old, the hydrocephalic boy, the girl whose muscles do nothing but contract. Composition, color values, the photographer has serious chops. Down generations beyond counting, poison will plunder. How portentous the equipoise of syntax. A magazine on whose back cover a couple lounges on the lip of a rooftop pool. Just one of the amenities to which their mortgage payment entitles them. Poem is an elegy for Estelle Bennett, one of the three Ronettes. She was a sister of Veronica Bennett, better known as Ronnie Spector. Her last name was Spector because she married the lunatic homicidal genius who made these wonderful songs from the early to mid 60s. Anyway, I think that's all. Be My Baby. The desolate facts of her post-Ronettes time aside, all I know, and it's everything, is her voice, sassy and nasal and bright, near Ronnie's, and the shimmery bullseye blasted through the Art Deco back door of the bottle cap, jelly jar, matchbook castle, specter brooded up out of nothing, but bash and swagger and more white lipstick and knees and beehives, gothic as sharp, and thighs and women's thighs of thighs, boy. She sang that maw of a chorus, all three shimmying Ronettes thrust their willowy bare arms out and near screamed the command borne along, white water roar that drowned the slap on the ass, tambourine and wheedling plea and Valhalla drums, and the facts matter. None of us 12 anymore and some dead. Us, those who woke up one day to find something called a transistor radio pressed to an ear, with a thing a billion words couldn't say, filling what didn't need filling the night before, which should mean no one who made or heard it knew anything but joy from then on. But that's a last call, I promise, of a will of innocence. And 3 minutes of the sublime don't make Estelle Bennett's 40 years of mostly pain worth it, or pardon anyone's sins. But say you're Patti Smith, doing the Watusi in a cellar outside Pittman, New Jersey. Or John Reff, swatting his knee in a sweltering attic in Vineland. Both you and thousands more devotees of WIBG in Philly belting out, "Be my little baby, my one and only baby. A woe, a woe, a woe, a woe." And 40 years later, Smith thrusts her willowy arms out into a hot Pittsburgh encore, howls the chorus with a blissful grimace, while Rep in the balcony watusis his sagging ass off. That matter. My God, do they ever. I'll end with this poem, which is set in Taos, New Mexico. I'm called Aspens. Aspens clatter in the wind outside the casita where I read Northrop Frog on the Apocalypse. Finished for now, with teeth pulverizing contemplation of class enmity, I bask in the light of brief days. The one in 3 doors down told me this morning of the instructions the crows had inferred from the visored men in the black jet. Best listen when crows or magpies speak. I wave whenever I walk to the graveyard where Kit Carson's bombed us, despite what he and his did to so many. Forgetting history for days at a time now, I stroll the consecrated ground behind the chapel where 3 signs speak of keeping valuables safe. Mockingbirds, a pinon, 3 boys zipping a frisbee, 5 aspens, a bench, blue as the doors open to the cool darkness of the sanctuary. Fry said that scriptures are a vast metaphor, hiding the real to reveal it. Each of us, Moses, dying inside of Canaan. So far, work, reading, and a skepticism I can't but call healthy are my worship, but only a fool would fail to listen up this high on the mountain. Thank you very much.
Wow. Thank you so much. It is a special joy. And just such a wonderful joy to be introducing Jan Beatty, whose seventh book, American Bastard, won the Red Hand Nonfiction Award 2021. And whose last book before that, The Body Wars, was described by Naomi Shihab Nye as shimmering with luminous connection. How they travel, a big life, and grand map of encounters. Then he worked as a waitress, abortion counselor, and in maximum security prisons for 15 years. She directed creative writing at Carleton University, where she ran the Mad Women in the Attic and the MFA program. Her new book, Chapbook Skybook, was just released by Lefty Blondie Press. And she has a new book coming out in 2024 from the University of Pittsburgh Press called Drag Stripping. And I owe her so much because about 18 years ago or so, she did her very best to help me try to figure out how to be a poet. I owe her so much. Please welcome Jan Beatty. Thank you, Joan.
18 years.
Yeah, I think it's probably.
But you were both children.
They were?
You were both children.
We were infants.
Yeah.
That time. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks. You know, thanks to White Whale. Thanks to all of you for coming. And I'm so happy to read about you guys. I mean, you're all my favorite poets. I was so happy to find out I was reading with you. So, and thanks to Joan and Chris for doing this every week. Okay, so I'm going to read a couple poems from Sky Dog. And, you know, this is my checkbook, and it's from Lefty Blondie Press, which you probably know by now is a great press, edited by Amy Lee Heinlein and Margaret Miller. And it's so cool because it's handmade, hand sewn. So check it out. There's some copies up there. Okay. Starlings. My wings flat, perfect cardboard painted white with lines for feathers. The blue sky robes hung heavy and terrifying on me, dragging as I walked. I was the angel in the school play, the awkward body masquerading on stage. 10 years old, I was always dressing up to be one of them. Not the angels, but the children. Peeling my name off my tiny body, I left it. I couldn't stay with them. There was no ancient belonging, no way forward. In some other sky, I made my own stars, and I filled the sky and night. The other small bodies moved from here to there on stage. I remembered what I had read in the dark green encyclopedia, in the fat red dictionary, where my love is never starless. And so I could fly away, and so I could walk and talk among them as if I were there. So this is, it seems like we're all talking about elegy in some way, and I have a lot of father poems, but this is sort of about that time when you don't realize how sick someone is. And this goes back a long ways to like my first big adventure when I think it was 1985, I went to this workshop called The Flight of the Mind. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but it was in the Cascades in Oregon, and it was all women. Judith Barrington was teaching, and it totally blew my mind, and it was the beginning of things. And so my father was sick, and I didn't know that the day I left, he went into a hospital, and he didn't want me to be told that he was going into the hospital. And so I didn't know for 2 weeks until I was coming back. I was riding on the train back from Oregon. So this is when I came back. It's called Sky Blue. When I show my dad the photos from the trip, he lay on the couch covered by a napkin. He turns the photos over to the white side. Oh, he said, in a weak voice, these are nice. What does he see in the white? Is he halfway to the other world and the sky door pulling him through? Dear father, so much you are alone with. I show you these photos, but now you take a hard right to your elemental song as your internal light of weeping fades. I hope the whiteness is the hand of night in charge of your new flight. Okay, I'm going to read an uncharacteristic love poem here. I don't have that many. This is for Dawn, and this is in Wyoming, called Half Sun Over Powder River. Half sun over the bighorns, white clouds graze the foothills, and you're on my mind. Your skin on mine, voice sleepy low. I'm resting my eyes as you fall deep into me. Light beneath the clouds, an alien breakthrough, strange dream to the sky. If you fly that shimmering to powder river running down in the high plains, you'll find that cool sun sky where sand looks like dust, a dust that runs to the underground earth, where the three forks meet, the swirling below, the fire circle, this sweet life with you. So strangely, this is a true story. Spread sound true stories. And if you've ever been at the Swiss Girl post office, maybe it's not that hard to believe what he said. In line at the Swiss Girl post office, he kept petting his long gray ponytail. He turned and said, I'm on my way to see my people. Haven't seen them for a lot of years. Want to go with me? I'm an Algonquin Indian, he strangely said. My people are in Canada, north of Quebec. What? I said. With his strange suede jacket, he looked like no one else in the post office. I got two cases of Yukon Jack for camping up north. The others in line were starting to listen. The woman in the brown wool coat gripping rubber-banded envelopes. The guy with finger tattoos and steel-toed boots. Oh yeah, that should be fun, I said. His eyes were heavy brown. So you'll go then. No, I'm not going, I said. But I hope you have a great time. Well, he said, human beings are changing at the DNA level. Is that right? I said. Everyone loves a loaded gun, he said, then stepped to the counter. Two pages of Elvis stamps. Then he left, casting the door open wide, his fringe swinging in time with his long stride, laying open the holster rawhide to his fly. In the shifting winter air between doors, he turned and said, if you come, you'll meet my ancestors. The dead will be there too. Yeah, like after he left, I'm like, did that happen? Was he there? Keeping it strange, these new poems. This is called Green Comets of Future. Down County Road 18, outside of Stowe, my head flying the room of strangers. I was 15, doing peyote in some guy's trailer, buttons of weed, young enough. I was wearing my scapula around my neck, burning into my skin with its green string, praising. Immaculate Heart of Mary, pray for us now in all scary caps. On the other side, Mary in long robes, holding this flaming, bloody heart. The green comets of future spinning, catapulting me in and out of time. And I thought about my pillowcases at home, sewn into a sleeping bag for safety. The drapes pinned shut. Birds were flying around inside me in circles, white. I could feel the psychopathic swirling of air. Were they spirits returning to dive bomb the monstrous buildings of my past? In the cloud soup, in the cloud river of my brain, the hills and factories of Pittsburgh rose up like the only real things. What was it people wanted from me? What was I trying to hold together? I hurdled the broken down steps of the single wide, what passed for a country home on that green night. My head now the comets, my head now walking away. Couple more. This is, my next book is called Drag Stripping, and this is called Drag. with a line from Miriam. They say I have attachment disorder from years in the orphanage. I say I'm attached to dirt, to the grit of stones, pulverized metal from the slag heap. I learned touch from air. I fashioned love from strangers. Your families make no sense to me. My mother's the poor barrel of a 409. My heart's drag strip from the shredded tires of predators. Go ahead, think of me. Throw the red flag down. I'm one you'd never figure. Dead engine start, I'll leave you in the dust every time. And this is, you know, I have some poems about Rosaria Asylum in the Hill District, which is an orphanage where I was born. This is called The Emptying, Rosaria Asylum and Maternity Hospital, Pittsburgh, 1952. Mullions cut the windows into equal pieces. There were cats prowling the halls of the asylum. Nights, straight line rain hit the glass. The wooden rafters shook. Oracles in white uniforms scavenged, lifting us to their rooms under the heavy crucifix. Searching for prophecy in our small bodies, they held us to their flat breasts, drove their fingers inside us, dreaming of Jesus, how he would fuck them. Hallelujah. Whose seed am I? The oracle sang, hovering, as they licked and sucked in the dark, emptying everything. Mediums between the dirty town of the small room and the vast space. And I'm thinking of Fred ending on something funny or happy. I don't think I have that, so I'm going to. But I do have a little revolution poem. This is called Lowrider. Anthony was a lowrider, silver fire running up his leg. We third graders flamed as the nuns came running in their black orthopedic shoes. Where's Anthony? All 20 of us lined up for the bathroom walk, turned as we heard him scraping down the tiled hall, heard him dragging limp in the silver brace that ran outside his pant leg, around his heavy black shoe and up to his knee. A shining steel, his own metallic flame, shooting up his leg, the side panel of the bottom. And in his high gravel voice, he said, I'm here. You're late, said the nun jailers, the fat of their arms hanging like weird fruit or weapons, teethed in the sleeves of black cowards. Anthony, you have to keep up. You can't use your leg as an excuse. And the flames went spiking, and punishment came as if by tribunal. The low murmur spread through the line of uniformed 9-year-olds. They took his shoe. They're making him walk in his sock. Anthony, crying now, his brace shining as the sun hit through the 50s paned windows. We all moved slowly toward him, low and slow, a long snake. Just look up, we said. And everybody looked up, our hearts flaming. We were glimmering. We were metallic. We rolled under the water fountain and they couldn't even see our engines. 450s with a dirty hum as we glided past, leaving them in their wrecked house of religion. We saw sparrows through the paned windows, free and flying in formation. Anthony's brace scraping, his sock foot sliding, and we let loose the biggest shot of renegade air, hydraulics pumping, arriving together, while the nuns huddled in their cruelty by the classroom door, holding a crippled boy's shoe. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
it is so amazing to be able to be here together in person in this community and hear these poems. Thank you all so much. This is so good. Thank you. I would really like to suggest that we just give them a big round of applause because they are really. The poets need to hang around for the photograph. Okay, there's a photograph. This is like part of the ritual. There are a lot of books here. There are a lot of books here. And there are some really amazing books right up there that are going to be for sale by these authors and these poets. And I think we should really try to leave here with a couple of books, which we, of course, paid for. That's also very important. This is our poetry home, and we are thrilled to be here. In 2 weeks, Tuesday, May the 30th, our readers will be Jamie Andresik, Jody DePerna, Jay McCafferty, and Sarah Schottman. They will be doing, I believe, nonfiction or fiction. We don't know what they're going to do, but okay. But it's going to be, whatever it is, it's going to be great. I want to give a big shout out to, and some of the people here were involved, and I kind of, you know who they were, who were involved with making the Greater Pittsburgh Festival of Books, especially the poetry tent, really a triumph. There were wonderful poets reading there. It was a great experience, and I really hope that can continue. And I have a poem for you tonight, somehow picking up on, and we didn't plan this, but there's a theme here. So this is the poem by Jimmy Savetic. Now, Jimmy was Jimmy often wrote poems. He would stand up in front of Hemingway's, he would read at the end or sometimes at the beginning, and he'd shuffle through all these pages, and he'd often only read the titles because he knew he really couldn't read the poem. He'd say, oh, I don't think so. No, not that one. That one. Okay. Because he could be pretty blunt, direct. Okay. But a lot of those poems were also facetious, and there was what the poem starts off being about, sort of, and then what it's really about. And so so this is one of his facetious poems. None with a gun. I have pondered these things for a long, very long time. And I've tried deep in my soul to deliberate a fundamental truth and understand the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. And why did Bart punch a nun in the belly? It has kept me awake in the wee hours of the morning, staring at the dark ceiling. I keep thinking and trying to understand. We all have a right to defend ourselves. And if someone comes into my home, I have the right to bless them and hold these truths to be self-evident, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if the Ruskies invade, we can pop them out of their shoes, not to mention any space invaders that come to our country and want to capture our lump citizens and make puppy chow out of them. And did I mention the zombie? Imagine asking a zombie, do you feel lucky, punk? And I know a larger question. What about the razor edge? What about the razor edge of justice and mercy? And how many times in my life I have asked for mercy like the song Marvin Gaye sang before his father shot him into the next world. Blam, blam, blam. Mercy me, things aren't what they used to be. Arm the teachers? A nun with a gun. Thinking a nun with a gun. A Dominican sister of mercy or a little sister of the poor packing. Thinking back to Sister Brenda. And if she was armed with a gun, I would not be sitting here pondering the Second Amendment. That nun didn't need a gun. She had eyes in the back of her head and she could spin around like a top, a superhero, a ninja. And with a piece of chalk with any Oakley accuracy could shoot you right in the middle of your head. And she was tough, rosary beat tough, ram tough, lather quick and lather tough and new when she had was pushed enough. And when enough was enough, and that's all she could stand, and she would street fight. I already told you about Tom Bailey in another poem, but I saw her take her nun boots to Tommy and lift him up off the ground by his ear, seeing her bounce many a head off blackboards and stretch many a sinful boy to amazing grace. Especially those boys who were staring too long with lechery and immoral thoughts, smiling at a little girl's patent leather shoes. I believe in my heart of hearts. And if Sister Brenda had been armed with a .44 Magnum, Tommy Bailey would be born nailed dead and would have been carried off by six of his peers. But when I think about it more, just makes sense. A nun with a gun, and she could conceal a .44 under her penguin outfit, and nobody would know she was packing. And the more I think about it, I bet it would help secure our fundamental principles, except for mixing church and state. Now I'm going to be up the rest of the night pondering, in God we trust. And someone prying the gun from Sister Brenda's cold hand. And tell you true, I still don't know why Bart belly punched the nun. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, everyone. Let's
and we'll see you in 2 weeks. And again, thank you to the poets.